is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, together with co-host Gina McAndrews. Hi, Gina.
Hello, Susan. It's always a lovely time to co-host with you, though I think this is a show that would be great for Paul.
Yes, it is, and he'd be here, except he's driving a friend to the doctor at 7:45. So we'll be thinking of him as we discuss a book about Midwestern movie stars of his generation.
What's the book, and who are the movie stars?
The book is Going Hollywood, Midwesterners in Movie Land by Sarah Jordan Heintz. And according to the description on its book jacket, it is the first book of its kind to chronicle the story behind 12 Hollywood legends. Clark Gable, Carol Lombard, Jean Harlow, Spencer Tracy, Ann Baxter, Jean Seberg, Jane Russell, Dorothy Dandridge, Rock Hudson, Marilyn Maxwell, Jane Wyman, and Luella Parsons, all from America's heartland.
Just last night, she was at the Erickson Public Library in Boone with a book reading of Going Hollywood. It's too late to preview it, but maybe some of our listeners were there.
Well, I hope some of them heard what she had to say, but I can tell she has a lot more that would interest our listeners. That's why I asked her to let us call her during the show today, and I know she's on the phone just waiting for the first question. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us today. How was the book reading last night?
It was so much fun. I can talk for hours about these celebrities.
Did you have an audience of people who remembered them?
Yes, and what I enjoyed was seeing some younger faces, too, in the audience.
Oh, how young?
Well, I'm 29, so maybe 20s, 30s.
Of course, you became interested in these people. How did that happen?
Well, I've always considered myself a bit of an old soul. I love classic cinema. I love the oldies music, 60s, 70s, that type of thing. So I just grew up watching Turner Classic Movies. It was just kind of an organic situation. My parents, Larry and Julie, are both baby boomers, so they remembered some of these stars maybe more from television in the 60s, 70s. And we talk about them a little bit, and I'd say, well, if you like this actress, you got to see her in this movie from the 30s. You won't recognize her if you knew her more from the 60s. And so it was certainly an interest that was encouraged, but it just sort of happened.
Well, how did you start writing about them?
Sure. So my family business is called Midwest Today Magazine. My parents started it in the early 90s. My mother on the business sales end of it, and then my father, the publisher, head writer. And I've always loved to write. And so in my early teens, I had pitched the idea to my father, can I start writing? And it started with maybe more fluff pieces, doing recipes, fashion. And then I said, well, because we're a Midwest-based magazine with that tie-in, could I do old Hollywood profiles? And I will confine the list of people to celebrities from the Midwest, people born in Iowa, Minnesota, Ohio, those types of states, and then do a profile on them. And so this idea was born in about 2006 with my first profile on Carol Lombard.
Oh.
Yeah. And so all these 12 people were each individually a magazine article through quite a period of time, up through about 2015.
And then how did you decide to put them together?
Well, I had a few friends who are also authors say that it was kind of a clever idea to focus on Midwest old Hollywood celebs and to take those chapters, kind of polish them up, expand and extend them a little bit, and then put it into book form. So this all came about in about 2015, but, you know, life happens. At this point, I was working full-time at the Marshalltown Times-Republican newspaper, doing features and business reporting. And that kind of took the priority and was more of that kind of day-to-day work. And I kind of shelved the book project until kind of late 2018. and just really wanted to get it done. And so the book's been out for a little over a year now.
By the way, I heard, I mean, when I was looking for your book online, I saw there was another Going Hollywood, a movie, actually. Does that have anything to do with your title choice, or is it just a coincidence?
Well, I think that Going Hollywood has become a bit of an expression. So certainly that movie is kind of that precursor to that expression. You know, you've gone Hollywood. It's just a whole different lifestyle. So I'm really just kind of using it in a more generic pop culture kind of reference way.
Well, in some of the things you've written, you talked about the research that you'd done and that you had dug up some pretty racy facts. What were your research sources?
Well, in some cases, I was able to interview relatives of these stars. So I talked to Marilyn Maxwell's niece, Ann Baxter's daughter, Dorothy Dandridge's cousin, and then Jean Seberg's sister. So that's always great when you can interview someone as a firsthand source. But in other cases, I just relied on newspaper archives. And as you know, there were so many magazines that came out during these decades, just way more than we even have today, that were lifestyle in nature, fan movie magazines, and these celebrities just did countless interviews. So it was always nice for me to be able to quote these people firsthand. Maybe they did an interview with Look magazine or Saturday Evening Post, those kind of throwback publications, Look magazine, things that are Look and Life that are now defunct. So those were great resources.
Well, it sounds like it would be very fun research to do.
Yes, it was.
We talked about maybe just focusing in on a couple of the stars, particularly the two from Iowa. So I think there are probably some people who don't even know who Marilyn Maxwell and Jean Seberg were.
Well, and that's unfortunate because they have amazing stories. So I'll lead this off with Jean Seberg. She was born in Marshalltown in 1938 and really wanted to become an actress. And amazingly, despite no formal acting training, when she was just shy of 18, she beat out 18,000 contestants for the role of Joan of Arc. And this was in the 1957 film St. Joan, directed by Otto Preminger. So she became this overnight success, got on all of these magazine covers, on television, because she'd won this coveted role. But unfortunately, the film kind of tanked at the box office. Preminger cast her in a follow-up film called Bonjour Tristesse, starring David Niven. That didn't go anywhere either. So really how Jean became kind of this cultural icon was turning to French New Wave cinema. And she was in a film called Breathless, directed by then an unknown Jean-Luc Godard. And so this film Breathless just exploded in Europe. And Jean had the short pixie haircut about a decade before Mia Farrow did. And Jean really caught on in European cinema. Now she continued to make some American films, but Europe was really her home. She ended up having kind of this affair with writer Romain Gary while he was still married. They had a child together in the early 60s, and she just really continued to build her career. Now, where I guess you could say scandalous things started to happen and kind of the intrigue is Jean was a very leftist, progressive kind of person. She joined the NAACP as a teenager, and she wanted to get involved in helping black at-risk children. And that translated to giving money to the Black Panther Party, initially for their free breakfast program. But at that time, the FBI was heavily involved in COINTELPRO, and that involved surveillance of people that they deemed to be kind of muckrakers and people who needed to be censored and monitored. So this all came to a head in April of 1970. And Jean was on the phone with Black Panther members Elaine Brown and Raymond Hewitt. And at that time, Raymond Hewitt was in a bit of a love triangle. He had two women that were pregnant, impregnated. And Jean had jokingly referred to him as Johnny Appleseed. And it was all kind of in good fun, kind of poking fun at them. So the FBI is listening in on this phone conversation, and they know Jean herself is pregnant and estranged from her husband at that time. So they think they have struck blackmail gold. And then just 6 days later, R.W. Held of the Los Angeles branch of the FBI sent a memo to J. Edgar Hoover saying that they want to plant a story with a newspaper columnist. It ends up being Joyce Haber out in Los Angeles. And so they want to plant this story that Jean is pregnant by a Black Panther. And this is so scandalous, having an interracial child, being pregnant by a revolutionary. They really thought this would cheapen her image and ruin her film career. And so Hoover writes back and says, pretty much, great idea, but let's wait 2 months until Jean would be showing and her pregnancy would be more obvious. And this is on her FBI file. And he wrote that Jean Seberg has been a financial supporter of the Black Panther Party and should be neutralized. And that's the word that was used, neutralized. So this exploded in the press. Jean was living overseas at this time, ended up going into premature labor, and her little girl, Nina, was born prematurely on August 23rd of 1970 and died 2 days later, and that baby is buried in Marshalltown in the Seberg family plot. And I would say that was kind of the beginning of Jean's mental decline, her physical decline. She was never the same again. She really started to transition out of Hollywood, predominantly living and working overseas. And sadly, she kind of went through a series of husbands and kind of the abuser kind of situation, and ended up being found dead in the backseat of her car on August 3rd of 1979 of a probable suicide. Although there's still a lot of oddities surrounding her death, but it was deemed a suicide. She left behind a teenage son. And then her former estranged husband, Romain Gary, ended up taking his life a year later.
What a tragic story.
It is, and there's so much to it. And of course, having just come from Marshalltown myself, I lived there almost 5 years. There are people there today that went to high school with Jean that I got to know. And it's just such a normal town with very kind people, a lot of interesting businesses, a very artistic community. And it's just weird picturing this woman having walked the halls, walked the streets. It's just almost surreal that the story started in Marshalltown.
Well, now, can Marilyn Maxwell be more dramatic than that?
I don't think so, but there's a lot of interesting things about her, too. So Marilyn Maxwell was born in Clarinda in the early 20s. And, of course, Clarinda is best known as the hometown of Gwen Miller. So her mother wanted her to be an actress so badly that Marilyn was actually her middle name. Her first name was Marvel because her mother thought Marvel Maxwell would look great on a movie marquee. Now, as Marilyn got older, she decided, no, that was kind of stupid. I'll just go by Marilyn. So really what she got started with as a singer and got into movies and was also a well-known USO performer for the troops. And that's kind of how she started this friendship first with Bob Hope, and they did some movie work together. But I would definitely say her biggest scandal was this on-again affair she had with Bob Hope. And it was so hot and heavy that people on the Paramount movie lot referred to her as Mrs. Bob Hope. And Marilyn also had a fling with Sinatra. Of course, who didn't? It seemed like just about everyone did. So she was glamorous. She was this perky, blonde bombshell years before Marilyn Monroe hit the scene. And did a few movies that are pretty popular. The Lemon Drop Kid is kind of a unconventional Christmas time movie she made with Bob Hope. And that claim to fame is they were the first two to sing the now classic song, Silver Bells. So they were the first. Some of her other movies include Rock-A-Bye Baby, Summer Holiday, and Champion with Kirk Douglas. And the other tie-in in my book is Rock Hudson featured in my book. And they were best friends, which I thought was really kind of cool. They had these very different careers, of course. Rock Hudson, a much bigger star. And they were linked romantically, of course, in the newspapers and magazines. And to me, it's a lot like a Will and Grace relationship, like the television show. Obviously, Marilyn knew that he was bisexual and was not going to be in a monogamous relationship with her, but they still had a lot of fun together. They loved to sit around the piano and sing and go to movie premieres and were really just the best of friends. So much so that when Marilyn died very tragically at age 50 in 1972, Rock Hudson considered adopting her teenage son. But the young man ended up going to live with his father. The parents were divorced at the time. So it was a really cool backstory I got from Marilyn Maxwell's niece, Kathy Katz, just about growing up and when she'd visit Marilyn Maxwell, Rock Hudson would be there, or he would just come and stay with her and her family because they lived in New York. And when he'd visit New York for, I would think, movie business types of things, he would stay with Marilyn's brother and his family. So that was kind of a fun thing to uncover, that this glamorous actress from Clarinda had quite a relationship with Rock Hudson.
Yes, to say nothing of Bob Hope.
Yes. Well, and of course, how long was he married to Dolores? You know, 60, 70 years. But I'm assuming he stepped out of the marriage with other people, too, during that time. But I guess Marilyn was first in line if he ever did leave Dolores.
And where was Rock Hudson from?
He was from Winnetka, Illinois.
That's a new town.
Yeah. Well, I know Winnetka.
Yeah?
Yes, we used to go to sailing regattas in Winnetka. It's an upscale suburb of Chicago, right?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, they're very close. That's a good way of putting it.
And Clark Gable?
Yeah, so he was from Cadiz, Ohio. Started manual labor jobs, worked in the oil fields, and just really wanted to become an actor and headed out east to New York. And then, like so many, transitioned out to Hollywood to do movie work.
And Spencer Tracy?
He was from an Irish Catholic family in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And now, if Paul were here, he'd be asking you some questions about Spencer Tracy. He's always talking about Spencer Tracy.
Can you tell us a little bit about Spencer? Because I'm sure Paul's listening.
Yes. Well, Spencer Tracy, at least to me, is one of the greatest actors of all time. You can just watch him in anything, and he takes on any character he plays. It's so effortless. And what I learned in doing research is he was a very insecure person, would kind of panic right before he'd go on that movie set for the first time, had a drinking problem. And really his long-term relationship with Katharine Hepburn, while it was probably a romance, I think there was a lot of a caregiver role that Katharine provided. You know, she would say, you need to exercise more, and eat better, and they were such a yin and yang situation, their dynamic.
Well, I'm sure Paul will enjoy that one. Now, we could probably go on and on with this, but I think of course, you have some books that people could read more of these stories in, right?
Did you get some books signed last night?
I did. That's always fun to autograph copies.
Are they for sale in any bookstores in Boone?
Not yet. It is on Amazon as a paperback or ebook. But if you do want it signed, go to my website. It's pageturnerbooks.biz. pageturnerbooks.biz. And then you can send me a message when you do the purchase, the checkout, and I can autograph it however you'd like and personalize the message.
What a neat idea.
Yeah. I love signed books by authors. It's so personal.
Well, thank you for this peek into the world of entertainment. This is KHOI Community Radio, and we've just heard about Going Hollywood, Midwesterners in Movie Land, from author Sarah Jordan Heintz. We'll transition to a completely different story by the same writer, but I wanted to conclude this segment with appropriate Hollywood music. I asked Tom Beale, host of KHOI's Movie Music Show, which plays on Friday at from 9 to 10 for Morning Masterpieces, and on Sunday afternoon for a two-hour version from 4 to 6 p.m. Here's a clip from MGM's That's Entertainment.
While the jury is out or the thrill, when they're reading the will or the chase, for the man with the face, that's entertainment.
The dame who is known as the flame
of the king of an underworld ring.
He's an ape who won't let her escape.
That's entertainment. It might be a fight like you see on the screen, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen, some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gang may be waving the flag that began with a mystical hand. Hip hooray, the American way. The world is a stage, the stage is a world of entertainment.
In case you just turned in, this is KHOI Community Radio. And my co-host, Susan Franzen, and I have been talking with Sarah Jordan Heintz about her book, Going Hollywood, Midwesterners in Movie Land. Sarah also writes stories for the Boone News Republican. And one of these caught our eye because it was about the upcoming Saturdays with a Scholar.
Yes, thanks, Sarah, for your first story. But the fact that you're also a journalist writing for the Boone News Republican means you can tell us about what other people in the area are doing. I noticed an article with your byline telling about next Saturday with a Scholar at the Boone History Center from 2 to 4 p.m. on February 8th. Who's the speaker for that?
That's going to be Larry Adams, and he is a longtime resident and historian in Boone.
Did the Historical Society ask you to write the article, or did you hunt him out?
Well, I have been typically previewing specifically for the different events. So it's just kind of a human interest type of situation. So I follow their calendar and reach out to them about a week before they have their next event.
So were you able to interview Larry Adams himself?
Yes. I gave him a call over the phone, and we talked a little bit about his career and a little bit about what he'll be covering at his talk, which includes counterfeiting money, the history of that, and kind of the evolution of the Secret Service.
Why was the Secret Service founded?
Well, it actually started to combat counterfeiting because, unfortunately, there was so much money on the market that was not issued by the government. And it was such a problem that this agency formed really just to combat that first. And then it wasn't until 1901, when President McKinley was assassinated, that some of those duties shifted to protection and bodyguard services of officials.
Well, from your article, though, the counterfeiting problem was a big problem early. When was that? Was that right after the Civil War, or was it earlier than that?
Yeah, that's about the time, at least kind of how Larry had described it to me, 1860s. It continues to be a problem.
Well, but what did they do to combat this?
Well, one of the things that I think helped is there was a series of booklets to educate the public about counterfeit currency, And what Larry also talked to me about, which I thought was really fascinating, during the World War II era, there was counterfeiting of ration books. And I could see how that would be kind of a hot commodity on the market, that if you'd used your stamps for the month and still wanted to get some of these goods, these books were available on the black market for people that were really desperate.
I remember those stamp books and remember getting a present for a pair of a stamp for shoes.
Was there much counterfeit going on in Boone, or how's the Boone connection fit in?
Well, I don't know if Larry is going to go into that so much. He, though, of course, is a Boone resident, and you might remember him as serving as the curator of the Mamie Eisenhower birthplace for quite a long time. He served as that curator from 1980 to 2006. So I think he's definitely a familiar face around town.
What's his background? Did he grow up in Boone? Or?
No, but it sounds like he's lived here a good long time. He currently is the curator of the Higgins Museum of National Banking in Okoboji and a past president of the Society of Paper Money Collectors. And he's been involved for a long time with the Boone County Historical Society, editing their Trail Tales journal. And he is currently a board member. And he just has a very interesting background in investigation, and he served as a forensic consultant and a document examiner, because there's lots of different things that could be forged, right? You know, we're just thinking of documents or signatures, famous people, just kind of trying to manipulate these documents, I'm sure, for financial gain. So I think he'll talk a little bit about that, too. It's quite a broad topic, so I'm not sure quite how it's all going to evolve in his program, but I'm sure it will cover a little bit of everything.
So he was hired as a forensic consultant? Like they would call him in to check money over or that sort of thing?
Yes, and I think he'll probably go into a little more detail about kind of when that was and who he worked for. That I'm not positive about. Again, you know, we kind of want to get people in the door at this talk, so we try not to reveal everything in the preview article, just kind of give you a little taste of it.
Makes me wonder if there was any connections then with the Al Capone and the, you know, the whiskey and the whole Prohibition time too.
Sure. Yeah, that all just kind of opened a can of worms when all that stuff was going on with organized crime syndicates and the explosion of that.
Well, since this is a preview, because you know what interesting stuff he has to talk about, why don't we just talk a little about the event? I'd like to say a little bit about the Saturday with a Scholar, because I have attended one of those, and I thought that it was a really nice experience. It's a great little auditorium, and it was packed with nobody I knew, so it must be all Boone people. And lots of good questions. It was a very, you know, they have a good setup there and a good audience to ask questions, which will make this more interesting. And then afterwards, they have very nice refreshments, so you can stand, you know, can talk to people about.
So it's at the museum, or
oh yeah,
yeah, and that's on 602 Story Street.
Yeah. Great. That sounds like a great event. And that's going to be every Saturday for how long?
Well, they have just a few scheduled out. I know the March event is going to deviate a little bit from the setup. It's going to be a trivia night, and that's going to be March 14th from 7 to 9 p.m. So they kind of schedule as they find people and commit them to the process. But it sounds like this is something they're wanting to have be a mainstay as a monthly offering, but they're not all scheduled just yet.
Okay. So he's only speaking one time?
Yes. All of these speakers have just been one time, and they've been pulled from Boone and then some Iowa State professors so far. It's just been kind of some local experts, if you will, on their particular field.
Oh, that's great. Well, How long has this been going on?
Not that long. I remember when I started at the paper, it was just kind of a late last year thing, I believe. I know there have been kind of, you know, there have been some turnover there, and kind of what are they going to do? What are they going to keep offering? And it sounded like it was very important to the board to say, okay, this is something new we're starting. We'll see if people are interested and make this a steady program. And I know there's other things they're working on, trying to get some other speakers in. But the Saturdays with a Scholar, I think, was just kind of that first step in getting back on people's radar in Boone, that that organization is still going.
Yeah,
and
it seems like
they're committed to not just local history, but the mission of telling stories and getting experts in and kind of broadening their scope too.
I mean, it could be fun just to get older people in who have stories to tell, the histories.
Yes, and I definitely think from attending these events, it's quite a mix of people, and I'm sure some of them have their own stories they could share as well. Oh, well, thanks.
And can you remind us what time these are on Saturday?
Yeah, so these take place on these designated Saturdays, and they're always from 2 to 4 p.m.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and it's on their website?
I think if you want to stay up to date, maybe the Facebook page, their Boone County Historical Society Facebook page is up to the minute.
Well, this sure sounds like an interesting lecture. That's next Saturday from 2 to 4 at the Boone County Historical Center at 602 Story Street in Boone. Thank you so much for being with us today, Sarah. We sure appreciate it, and we sure wish you well, and hopefully you'll come back.
Yes. Thanks so much.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you are listening to Local Talk with co-hosts Susan Franzen and Gina McAndrews. Sarah Jordan-Heinz has been telling us about a couple of events in Boone. We'd like to turn now to a couple of other towns that will have a different kind of entertainment this weekend, community theater. First, we have a story that came to my attention through an article in the Story City Herald. It was about Joe Farrell of Roland. Here's what he told me. I wanted to talk to Joe Farrell because I saw on the front page of the Story City Herald that he was a lead in Leading Ladies, an actor's production. Now, we don't usually cover actor's production, but when their lead is a star in Story City, I think that's a Local Talk story. So I called Joe to find out how he got involved with actors.
So I've been involved with Judge Story, I think it's about 5 years now. I actually, my daughter had been doing Judge Story for quite some time, and we were doing Tarzan up here, and I was approached by the director, Veronica Score, asking me if I would help out as a male ape during Tarzan. And I said, sure, I can do that. There's not a whole lot to be done. I can sit in the back and be an ape. And then I found out I had to learn music and choreography and dance, and did a lot more than I expected for that show. So that was kind of my gateway drug back into theater. I had done it in high school and a little bit in college and had been out of it for quite some time. So I've done several productions with Judge Story. And then last year, about the same time period, actors did And Then There Were None, the Agatha Christie mystery. And that was a show that interested me. We actually talked about doing it up here at some point with Judge Story. So when it was available, and I thought on kind of a whim, I had a hole in my schedule where I wasn't going to be real busy. I thought, well, I'll try that out with actors. And had the chance, I got cast and had a great time with that show when I did it there. And it kind of was my draw me into actors at that point. This is the third show I've been involved with actors.
Of course, Leading Ladies requires some special acting ability. Did you find this challenging?
It is unlike anything I've ever done before, I will admit. You have a character playing another character while still being the original character. And that's, to me, that's been the challenge sometimes, is when I'm playing the role of Stephanie, the female character that Jack Clark is playing. I have to remember I'm still Jack Clark playing this character. I'm not actually Stephanie. So that's been kind of hard to get my mind around sometimes to remember what character I actually am.
For any of our listeners who haven't read the many wonderful newspaper stories on this, please tell us just a little bit of the plot and what's the setup.
So Jack and Leo are two kind of down-on-their-luck Shakespearean actors from England who are touring the Moose Lodge circuit in the United States doing scenes from Shakespeare. They're only able to do scenes from Shakespeare because there are only two of them and they don't have enough costumes to do entire show or enough actors to do entire show. So they have finished a rather unsuccessful performance. They were reading the newspaper about a millionaire who was looking for Max and Steve, we thought were nephews. And then they decide, well, maybe we could pose as Max and Steve because she hasn't seen them for many, many years, doesn't know what they look like. And they had apparently moved to England, so we are coming from England, so we could do the English accents. And then we find out that Max and Steve are actually Maxine and Stephanie. So we decide to dress as women. Well, Leo decides and kind of pulls Jack along to dress as women and pose as Maxine and Stephanie.
How much of this is in Shakespearean costume?
Actually, there's a little bit in Shakespearean costume. There's one scene that is preparing to do a Shakespearean play within the place we're at, with Florence, the aunt that we're posing to be her nieces. But there's a little bit at the very beginning where we do a very mixed up rendition of a Shakespearean show, which again is scenes from Shakespeare. So it's pulling from several different plays and none of the lines really belong together.
Well, I read that this was Some Like It Hot meets Twelfth Night.
Yes, I think you could say that, yes. There's the male-female play. We do have a couple of females that play male roles within the Shakespearean play of our cast members. So it is very much, I think that's a good description.
I think you've already said what the most difficult part was. But what was the most fun?
There's been a lot of fun parts. One of the most really interesting things is the chance to learn how to sword fight. So we were there with actual stage swords and metal flying around and clanging them together, and that's been really interesting to learn. I've never done that before, some stage combat to that magnitude.
Well, that's a surprising thing in a play like this, that would be the most fun. And Maxine and Stephanie were not involved in that.
No, that was us being Leo and Jack when we did the sword fighting at the very beginning of the show.
What was the greatest costume challenge?
Getting in and out of them is a huge challenge. We have several dressers backstage that have everything laid out for us and help us get into things quickly. There's a couple very quick turnarounds where Leo or Jack leave the stage and come back as either Maxine or Stephanie, or vice versa. We leave as Maxine or Stephanie and have to quickly come back as Jack or Leo. Bradley, who plays Maxine, has a very quick change where he's going back and forth very, very quickly between the two characters.
Well, I'm tempted to ask you what your shoe size is.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, because yesterday I was trying to get your phone number from Stan Raby, and he said he was out trying to find size 14 women's high heels.
I actually have two pairs of heels I wear at the shows. One is a size 15, and the other is a size 14 women's size. I have a size 13 men's shoe normally.
But apparently he thought you could use a bigger shoe.
Yeah, the size, again, like right now I have a size 15 and a size 14. The 15s fit really well. The 14s are pretty good but a little tight. Now, my foot apparently is wider than a normal size 14 women's shoe.
Well, I would imagine. How did your first week's productions go?
Oh, we had a great first run. We've had some fantastic audiences that have been very receptive. You don't know when you go in how well it's going to be received. You think you put things together, and you don't know until you hear how the audience reacts. So we've had great audiences, great reactions from the audiences. Dress rehearsal, we had several audience members who were rather versed in Shakespearean shows and have a lot of background there, so they were laughing at things that we did not expect to receive laugh lines at. So it's been a great run this first weekend.
Okay, and you have another weekend coming up. So what are those times?
That will be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday and Saturday will be 7:30 shows, and Sunday is a 2 o'clock matinee.
At Actors?
Yes, at Actors. 120 Abraham Drive.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your making time for me today. I think this is a delightful show. I'm looking forward to seeing it at the matinee. Yes.
That's great. Thank you. I appreciate the time and the opportunity.
It's not often that we have two theater productions to preview on the same weekend, but Ankeny Community Theater is opening a farce on February 7th to 16th. To celebrate this wealth of entertainment, I'd like to play another verse of That's Entertainment that has lines appropriate for the farce we're about to hear about.
The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights,
or the bride with the guy on the side,
or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment.
The plot and the hot simply teeming with sex.
A gay divorcee who is after her ex.
It could be Oedipus Rex,
where a chap kills his father and causes a lot of bother.
The clerk who is thrown out of work
by the boss who was thrown for a loss.
By the skirt who is doing him dirt.
The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.
This coming weekend, the Ankeny Community Theater will be opening a two-week run of Don't Dress for Dinner by Mark Camaletti, adapted by Robin Hodden. And we have Debbie Garner here to tell us about it. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, Susan.
What character do you play?
I play Jacqueline, and I am married to Bernard, who is planning a romantic weekend in his chic Parisian farmhouse, but for his mistress.
Oh.
Yes. Yes, that's what a farce does, yes.
In a French farmhouse, did you say?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's set in a French farmhouse, yes.
And so what does Jacqueline do to spoil the fun?
Oh, well, I tell you, Jacqueline has her own lover. And it just so happens that her lover is also her husband's best friend. And so, I tell you what, a farce is kind of much ado about nothing, using buffoonery and horseplay, I guess you would say. And so, Jacqueline's lover comes to visit her at her farmhouse. At the same time, Bernard's mistress comes. And so now you've got four people in the same place.
And when you say don't dress for dinner, that sounds like maybe don't dress at all.
Well, at Ankeny Community Theater, we have made this PG. But nevertheless, the ladies do end up in nightgowns. Actually, everyone ends up in robes and nightgowns in the end, but they make it into a game.
This sounds like a lot of fun. Please tell us a little about the director.
Oh, I would love to. Barbara Wagner has been a director in the Des Moines area for a long, long time. She started when Purple Dragon, the dinner theater, Charlie's Showplace, she directed many, many shows there. That was in Des Moines. And also she's directed many children's shows at the Altoona Theater. And she's directed many, many great shows at the Ankeny Community Theater. Barbara Wagner is a well-known, great director and one of the very few I know that can do a farce very, very well.
I am very happy that you are able to be in her play, because it sounds like you're going to have a marvelous time. Now, I have a sort of a logistical question, because the website says that it opens on the 7th. It's Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 for both weekends. But the 7th is a Friday, not a Thursday. So does it open on Thursday or Friday?
Preview is Thursday, actually, a preview night. That is an invited audience. We invite a few people just to see how it works.
You actually have a performance on Thursday, but people can't buy tickets until Friday.
Right.
And I didn't realize this until I was typing it up last night, and I thought, there's something I don't understand here. But and at that hour, I could only ask you. So we figured it out, I guess, or you figured it out. So people can buy tickets for this coming Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right. Sunday, our matinees, we have two of them. This Sunday and next, they're at 2 p.m., and they are my favorite, actually, because if you don't like to drive in the dark, especially during the winter time, Sunday at 2 is the perfect time to come.
It sounds like it's going to be a good weekend, and thank you so much for letting us call you today.
And it's my pleasure. We certainly do invite everyone to Ankeny Community Theater. Can I give people the address?
Please.
Yes, thank you. It's 1932 Southwest 3rd Street in Ankeny, right across the street, just north of John Deere. A lot of people know across the street from John Deere, and it's at the end of a strip center. You'll see a bright blue awning. Just aim to that.
And it's an intimate theater. It's really a lovely space.
Yes, and for tickets, they can call Midwest Tickets. Midwest Tickets is 515-244-2771. Or for internet savvy, just www.midwesttix.com.
Or your website.
Yes, absolutely, Ankeny Community Theater.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Boy, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So we have the theater at 1932 Southwest 3rd this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Midwest Tickets is the place to find those at 515-244-2771.
This has been a whole show full of enjoyable outings, which I think a lot of our Democratic listeners feel they really need. Did you go to a caucus?
Yes, I did. I sure had a great time. I volunteered and helped organize our caucus at 2-2, which is at the high school.
Oh.
And we had a great turnout. We had a few hundred people.
I was there as a reporter for KHOI, and all I did was describe the crowd for a few minutes. But I did get to talk to a young reporter from the Washington Post. She told me the Post had 40 reporters in Iowa that night. I reported in the first alignment, but we both left by 11 o'clock, when it was clear that they were just beginning to count for the second alignment.
At least our caucus went really well.
Well,
I think it's the app that was the big problem.
No, I think in our case, it was the organization. We didn't have everybody checked in until 9:30.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they didn't get their cards. And then they took another 15 minutes to make sure that they had the right amount of cards and the right amount of people. Actually, somebody whose caucus went very well let the people pick up the cards when they signed in. So they didn't have to worry about that matchup. But ours was they followed the book, and it took a very long time.
Wow. Yeah, ours was very smooth, and I think most everyone was almost gone by 9:30.
Well, yeah, ours were gone by 9:30. They handed in their cards, but they really never did a second.
I mean, we were done. Like,
you did the second alignment.
We did the second alignment and everything done by 9:30.
Okay, well, but there's one thing that I wanted to mention that I thought was really worth saying that was good about the caucuses. They had the satellite caucuses, and this enabled a lot of people who were normally not involved to be, which was, you know, like people who worked a night shift and wanted to come in the afternoon. But there were two that I read about on the Iowa Capital Dispatch that I thought were particularly noteworthy. And one was the Des Moines Muslim community. They had one in their mosque, and it was the first time ever that a mosque served as a caucus site, attracting 119 caucus goers through its doors and up to its prayer room, where Muslim Iowans sat cross-legged on a carpeted floor, filling out their cards. And it's very important for the Muslim community, said the imam for the Muslim community organization. The mosque is not meant just for prayer. It's meant for anything that has to do with Muslims and their well-being. So this was a way of involving a whole community. And at the same time the Muslims gathered, 187 other Iowans, almost exclusively Latino, gathered at the YMCA gymnasium on Des Moines' south side. Many were community organizers, activists, and leaders, and they ranged from college age to the elderly, with business professionals mingling with working class residents. Even before the participants began caucusing, it was obvious Sanders would be the only viable candidate. And both of these caucuses had a lot of Sanders organizers, which was probably an instigation for the satellite mm-hmm. location. There were pictures, incidentally, if anybody wants to look on Iowa Capital Dispatch. And in the mosque, the women had stickers on their jobs. So the point of this is really involving minority communities in the actual process of caucus.
And the discussions and learning from each other.
Learning from each other, yes. And broadening.
Because I think they're really a great community event because we need to do that more often. I mean, a lot of people you don't see your neighbors as much. And so there were a lot of good conversations and people sharing information with each other.
I see our time. We've got to close out. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Gina McAndrews and I are your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Sarah Jordan-Heinz, Joe Farrell, and Debbie Garner.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Don't forget, khoifm.org.
Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was That's Entertainment from the film The Bandwagon.
Local Talk is a radio production, training workshop, as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just hit that donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.